And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
First of all, confession time. Many of you thought that this particular podcast was going to be about the fine-tuning table using an all-value portfolio. And in fact, I did record that podcast. And as I finished, I looked over the page of numbers and noticed that one relatively, I would say, innocent number, it had to do with the fixed income return, I noticed it wasn't quite right. And then I looked more carefully and realized that the fixed income that was used in putting together the table for the all value portfolio was slightly different from the fixed income that was used in the worldwide equity fine-tuning table we've used for years, which means I don't have a pure apples-to-apples comparison, which means I have to get the table redone and make the podcast again so that it is the best that I know that it can be, and hopefully a great learning tool for you. In the meantime, I want to focus on an article I read this morning. In fact, I really enjoyed this article, even though I knew I was going to disagree with it, because it's written by an old friend, a friend of many years who's an investment advisor, and his name is Joe Schaefer. And I think I'm older than Joe is, but I do know this, that Joe, like myself, is absolutely committed to doing the best he knows for the people he serves. And he manages money for some, and he has a newsletter for those that simply want to read his recommendations. Maybe they use them, maybe they don't. But in this particular article, he says, the title is, Passive Index Investing is a Delusion. And so I'm going to turn that into a question and say, is passive index investing a delusion? And I will go through here the things that Joe has said, many of them true, by the way, about how passive investing works. But many of the comments are kind of the old world thinking about index investing. But again, I think it's worth addressing because we all have moments of wondering, is this really the best way? And that's something we should always continue to ask as we build toward whatever financial future we can build. He talks about a delusion. He says that's a belief that, though false, has been surrendered to and accepted by the whole mind as a truth. He differentiates from the word illusion, but the delusion is basically surrendering to a myth and absolutely believing in that myth. So here's a couple of the things that he has brought up in the article. And I'll read here from his article. And I can tell you from experience that every time a bull market has been in evidence for a number of years, index investing is always touted by the big mutual fund companies and ETF companies that offer such products, as well as most new-to-business financial journalists. Their reasoning seems convincing at first. Why try to beat the market? Only 20% of all active mutual funds or investment advisors beat the market. This is what Joe was saying. Or 25 to 30%, or whatever the most recent scholarly tome reports. Active funds charge higher fees than passive index funds is an example of what these people will say about index fund investing. Now, when he says 20% or 25 to 30% of the active funds are able to beat the investment advisors or the index funds, you know, it's an interesting, it's not a trick, because I'm sure that Joe believes it's 20 or 25 or 30%, but that implies there's a good chance to beat the indexes. Well, what we know from the S&P report, the SPIVA report, is that over the last 10 years, and this is through the end of June 2016, that on average only about 10%, some a little more, some less, have been able to beat the indexes. And in the SPIVA report, they look at small, mid, large, growth, value, U.S., international. The point is, very few funds are able to beat the index. And this is over a 10-year period. And from my point of view, that's not something that we get excited about, because there's a bull market. That's something we should be excited about, not about the past, but about the future, that if we use index funds, we are very likely to end up in that top 10%. Then Joe says, the presumption underlying these statements, for example, like active funds charge higher fees than passively managed funds, but the presumption underlying these statements is that it is best to sit quietly in the back seat of the car and let the adults of the investing world do your driving for you. Well, now, wait a minute. I mean, it's almost just the opposite. When you're in an actively managed portfolio, or having your money managed by an actively managed advisor like Joe is, he's not running a mutual fund, he's running individual accounts. Seems to me that having Joe drive the car and pick the stocks is really a matter of letting the adults of the investing world do your driving for you. You see, in an index fund, you're really not asking adults to drive it. What you're asking somebody to do is put together a portfolio that looks just like the S&P 500. It's not letting, in essence, an adult drive the car. It's letting a computer drive the car. But it is interesting to note, isn't it, that by having a computer drive the car, you're likely to come out with a better rate of return than having an adult or the active manager drive that car. But he does note a problem. He says, index funds are managed by a committee in order to be reflective of the current economy and the sectors that drive it. Stocks that don't perform are often dumped, and newer companies with greater momentum are added by the index's holdings committees. That, by the way, is true. The major indexes, like the S&P 500, it isn't the same 500 companies all the time. Each year they add some new ones as they take some old ones off. So there is a process that could in fact eliminate the idea of it being passive. But you know, the reality is that when you own 500 companies, or in some indexes, thousands of companies, the fact that they come in and monkey around with a few additions and a few subtractions, what's really important, I mean, that's a minor impact. What's really important is that you're exposed at all times to this very, very massively diversified portfolio. But he does say that a capitalization-weighted index like the S&P 500 inevitably places more emphasis on the most popular companies. as more buyers buy those most popular and raise the price of the component companies, the index fund is increasingly composed of high price-to-earnings ratios, high price-to-book, and high price-to-sales firms. See, we can call it passive, he says, but it is neither value-driven nor conservative at this point. And in fact, it's true that in the S&P 500, the top 50 companies are going to drive most of the performance. And in fact, back in the late 90s, when the S&P 500, during a five-year run, compounded at over 28%, it was the top 50 companies that really drove most of those big returns. But let's keep in mind, the way that that index funds are being used by firms and people, and I can look at the Merriman firm, my old firm, and all the DFA advisory firms in the United States, and all of those that use Vanguard index funds, they're putting together portfolios that the S&P 500 is likely a small part of. And if you look at the mutual fund and ETF portfolios that I've constructed, you'll notice the S&P 500 is about 10% of the portfolio, not 100. And one of the reasons I only want them to be a small part of the portfolio is because the return is being driven by a relatively few number of companies. And I want not only asset classes that make more, but that are more diversified in your portfolio. But Joe says the biggest problem he sees with passive index investing is that its sole goal is to equal the market. And that may be laudable in a rising market, he says, but unless you want to ride the roller coaster right back down again in a bear market, you need to make the active decision about when to get out. Is this decline a head fake? Is this one the real thing? Should I hold until it hits 20% down and then take my cash out, or should I take it out today? Or should I just hold and watch the gains evaporate? You know, the self-talk that you go through is fascinating. And what happens for people who go through this kind of self-talk is, I swear, the emotions take over the whatever intellect had any part of the conversation. Because what you're talking about are all these ways you could be losing money, and shouldn't you be doing something about it? Well, what we know from what happens in that conversation about should I just let the burning continue is that people don't like to lose money. They hate to lose money. They just absolutely detest losing money. They worked hard for that money, and I'm giving back, or maybe you're giving back hard-earned profits, or maybe you got in right at the top and you're giving up hard-earned money that you made from working for a living. Well, Joe says the first goal of successful investing should not be to beat the market, but rather to make steady progress in reaching your goals. And I think that's his point, is an important one. But the question is, are you better off? Let me tell you what happens. When a person believes that they know how to stop the bleeding when it starts, they don't need to be all that defensive with cash or with bonds, because they have faith that they'll be able to protect their investors. Now, it turns out that more people are probably better served agreeing with themselves up front how much risk they're willing to take, how much loss they're willing to accept, and building that into the portfolio. So, yes, they actually do sit there and watch their money go down without doing anything about it because they already did something about it. And that is to load the portfolio with a fair amount of fixed income. Many of you know that my wife and I have in our buy and hold portfolio half of the money in bonds. And it's not because we think we're going to make more money by having half the money in bonds. In fact, we think we'll make less. But it is our way of protecting the downside when the market unexpectedly goes down significantly. Now, if you think about it for a second, having 50% in bonds suggests that if you're living on 5% of the portfolio, you have about 10 years of annual income right there at any time. So, you know something, with 50% in bonds, I'm feeling pretty secure. And I don't have to worry about the market going up and down. And Joe here, he says, yet investors are told by the experts to just hang in there because the market always comes back, and no one can time it. Well, it's true. And he says even, it's true. It always does come back, and just maybe not in your lifetime. Well, Joe is painting a pretty bleak picture of what can happen. It's not an unrealistic picture. It is possible that a market could be down the rest of your life. Look at the Japanese market. Been down since 1990. Sells for, I think, maybe 40% of what it sold for in 1990. And it was king of the hill in terms of returns for the years up to the point that it then started this very major slide. And I'm sure there are a lot of people thought many times as it started up, it's coming back, and then it didn't. And this is, by the way, one of the reasons that you want to have a massively diversified global portfolio, because you should never depend on any one country. Having said that, lots of people depend a lot on the country that they love. It's called a home bias. Most Americans have that feeling. Most Germans have that feeling. Most Swedes have that feeling. Even in teeny tiny markets like New Zealand, where I'm going next week, even people in those markets have a home bias. Well, the fact is that what the experts will say is that when the market is going down, and by the way, this is going to feel very uncomfortable, rebalance, take money out of your fixed income and put it into equities when the market is down. And if the market keeps going down, take more money out of your fixed income and put it into equities. That's probably one of the most uncomfortable aspects of a buy and hold strategy, that rebalancing aspect. And then Joe says that the problem with the academic studies that these experts tout is they're trying to get you to stay fully invested all the time. Well, to some extent, that's true. But remember, they're trying to get you to stay fully invested for the part of the portfolio that's going to establish the major part of the risk you're taking. And the other part of the portfolio is there to protect against being absolutely catastrophic. So I think he's wrong. I don't believe that the academic studies say you should stay fully invested with everything you have. I think they do say that to the extent that you have the risk tolerance for 20% in equities, stay committed to that 20% exposure at all times. Then he talks about the Dow Jones and how it's a very unscientific portfolio benchmark. And it was when I was in the business back in the 60s. But today, the Dow Jones, although we still hear how much it's up or down, is rarely looked at as a major asset class. The S&P 500 would more likely be the group that investors would look at as the market. Joe notes another challenge as far as he's concerned. He said that if you placed $100,000 with the S&P 500 index on Friday, February 17th, $3,572 of it would be invested in Apple as the biggest in market cap, and $73 would have gone to News Corp. One of the other stocks, actually, it's the smallest company in the S&P 500. But he says that $20,000 of your $100,000 would be invested in 11 stocks, including Apple, Microsoft, Exxon, Amazon, J.P. Morgan, Johnson & Johnson, Berkshire Hathaway, that's Warren Buffett's company, Facebook, General Electric, Wells Fargo, and AT&T. So these are the giants that drive a lot of the value of the S&P 500. And as I mentioned, the S&P 500 is cap-weighted, and a relatively handful of companies are going to drive that index up and down. And most of the major indexes, and he discusses this in his article, like the New York Stock Exchange and the Wilshire Index of 5,000 companies, those are capitalization weighted. The larger companies represent a much larger percentage of the portfolio. And he does mention that the Wilshire Index that has 5,000 companies represents more than 95% of the market value of all 40,000 companies traded in America today. I didn't know there were 40,000 public companies. I thought it was a lower number than that. But again, as I mentioned earlier, one wants to be sensitive to overloading your portfolio to large cap companies through these indexes that are, even though they represent most of corporate America, 95% in the case of the Wilshire 5000 index, it's a handful of companies that are going to drive that index up and down. So if you really want to have exposure to all these different, like small cap value and small cap blend and large cap value and large cap blend, you're going to spread that over a number of different asset class mutual funds. And now he brings up a fascinating point that we should all be interested in. He said, of the 100 biggest companies in the United States 100 years ago, in 1917, only 15 survive as members of the top 100 today. So he may complain about the fact there's a committee making decisions about what companies qualify to be on or off the S&P 500. The fact is things in the public market of stocks change significantly. And what, for example, the Nifty 50 back in the early 70s, this was a group of 50 stocks that the professionals said, just own these 50 companies and you will have a great financial future. It turns out as a group, they made less than the S&P 500. Large cap value made more than the S&P 500. Small cap blend made even more than large cap value. And small cap value made even more than small cap blend, which means that all these other assets did better than the S&P 500, while the S&P 500 did better than the Nifty 50. So there was a better way. Passive indexes, even if managed by committees, have performed much better than people trying to pick the stocks that they think have a great future. Then he says something I think is fascinating. Please understand, I am not trying to discourage anyone from purchasing a passive index fund. I just think you should know what you're getting into before you do. But Joe, if what we're getting into is the lowest cost mutual fund we can buy, comprised of hundreds, and then eventually as we add more of these indexes, thousands of different companies, and we're getting these at a very low cost, and it turns out that the return of the markets that these indexes represent have produced returns, long-term returns of 10 to 12%, sometimes even higher. If you go back to the late 20s, why should I complain about getting into that? And then if I've been careful, either with the help of a investment advisor or a good book or someplace you got an education, so that as you added some fixed income, you reduced your risk. And by the way, it's what's fascinating is, and you're going to see this in that value fine-tuning table when you get it, you could have a portfolio of value companies and have 60% in 40% in bonds and make as much as having historically 100% in the S&P 500. You would cut your volatility and risk by over one-third, and still by being willing to diversify amongst large and small and value and growth and U.S. and international, you'd be able to get the return of the S&P 500, this amazing index that has done so well since 1928. And all you have to do is have the right amount of fixed income to address your risk tolerance. Pretty amazing possibilities. And in the last paragraphs, he slips in a line here that is the I think the goal of almost every money manager stock picker I've ever met. Joe says, I try to buy the shares of companies I believe have the best combination of balance sheet, management, and value as represented by share price and valuation ratios we use. And I think that's what people who are trying to build portfolios of individual companies should do. Now, the reality is that it gets way more complex than that, because not only do you need to understand the balance sheet, the management, and the value as represented by share price, you need to know the competition. You need to know the technology. How close to obsolescence is it? What are they doing to replace products that are becoming obsolete? There were some great companies in the past that did not adapt to the change in technology, and others then zoomed by them. So to pick individual stocks requires a great deal of analysis of that company, the competition, the economy, not the economy only in the country where the product is being manufactured, but in the countries where the product is being sold. That's a lot of variables and a lot of places where something could go wrong, and a lot of opportunities to become emotionally turned inside out, trying to figure out, I don't care whether it's Joe or Joe's readers or clients. The challenge is that it's hard to know how all those moving parts go together. So there are people that may from afar look like they're really lazy, and they put their money in index funds. But I think they're not lazy. I think they're smart. And I wish Joe well. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. He is a wonderful person. I want his clients to make a fortune. But I do know the probabilities are probably better for the people who simply buy index funds. I think not only will they make as much money as Joe, and probably they will even do that by adding some fixed income and reducing their risk, but I think they will do it with a lot less risk and greater peace of mind. Remember, we're all trying to improve our returns, reduce our risk, and to increase our peace of mind. I think those are the major three things that Joe is trying to do, that I am trying to do, that you are probably trying to do for others that you know need some help. And oh, by the way, when you know there are people who need some help, I know a lot of you are already doing this, but please direct them to our website. And now as I close, I'm just telling you, I'm really hoping that this weekend I'm going to be sitting down with a fellow by the name of Chris Pedersen. I've never talked about Chris before, but Chris is working with me on this new project, and I am for the first time going to do a podcast that includes another person. And for those of you who know how I hate technology, I mean, I have a love-hate. I love being able to do this podcast, but I know I should be interviewing other people that know more than I do and sharing their expertise with you. Well, I'm going to do that this weekend. It will come out next week. I will actually be in New Zealand for a vacation with my wife. We're celebrating her 70th birthday, going to New Zealand for a couple of weeks. But I'll have my computer with me. Can't wait to hear the feedback from people who learn about these new strategies and what we're building to do, help you do better with your investments, take the pressure off, give you the closest thing to me actually managing an account for you that I know how to become without being an investment advisor. Stay tuned. We're going to have some fun. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.